During Australia's Black Summer of 2019-20, a bushfire nearly destroyed the farm where actress Rachel Ward and her actor husband of 40 years, Brian Brown, well, not quite 40 years at that point, but certainly quite a few, had been raising cattle for 33 years. And this triggered Ward, who, with a neighbour, changed their conventional agriculture practice in favour of regenerative farming. She's now a champion for the movement, which aims to lower the ecological impact of farming and increase the health of the soil. Her documentary, Rachel's Farm, screens in cinemas and online in the Dock Edge Festival in June. And she joins me now. Hello.
Hello.
Are you on the farm?
I'm not on the farm, no. I'm in bed with a bad cold, so I hope I don't cough away too much. But
no.
I'm a bit under the weather. I'm in Broken Hill.
I'm sorry to hear that. Broken Hill.
Broken in Broken Hill, that's right. Yes, and it's very, very cold. And the combination of spending the weekend with my grandchildren, who all have colds, and, being out here, desert cold is a recipe for disaster.
Good
but
Lord.
Anyway, I hope you can hear me through my croaks.
I'm sure you've got some natural remedies lined up, just as the ones that you spread on your soil.
Yes, I have a few little natural remedies. Yes, they're not quite doing the trick yet, but we're getting there.
Now,
thank you.
Your New South Wales farm is, of course, a long, long way from the Cotswolds, where you were brought up on a farm.
Yes.
Was farming in your blood anyway?
I don't think so, really, no. I mean, my father owned a farm, owned land, and he had a farm manager and shepherds and things like that. I grew up really on a sheep farm, though, and with corn. We did a corn barley. So I did grow up in the country, and I grew up, you know, with tractors and combine harvesters, and we used to stand underneath the places where they kept the corn, and we used to stand underneath them when the combine harvesters poured all the corn into the containers, and we'd stand under like a corn shower, and then we'd be amongst. Yes, so I suppose I could say I was. It became in my blood, and certainly being in the country was in my blood, and I feel very comfortable in the country. Which is interesting, living with someone who didn't grow up in the country and, although he loves it, is not actually that comfortable in the country.
No, I get the impression from the documentary that he's a city boy.
Yes, he is. He's a suburban boy. And, you know, not that he can't adapt or appreciate it, but he doesn't. He's nervous of it in a funny way. You know, if we ride with him, he's very nervous about the gates and the wire we go through and other people's properties, and he's abiding laws that are, you know, are urban laws rather than sort of country laws. So
Was your farm a cattle farm when you bought it all those years ago?
It had a few cattle on it. It had about 30 head, but it was mainly a piggery.
And you converted it to cattle.
Well, slowly we got rid of the pigs. We weren't able to have pigs. Well, we really bought it as a lifestyle getaway. We used to spend every holiday, school holidays, we would chuff up the coast and spend the weeks, months there. And so, in the meantime, the kids were in school in Sydney, and we were working in Sydney. So we had a farm manager, and it was the original owner of the farm who was happy to go on managing the farm. So we got rid of the pigs, and we slowly increased the cattle, and we slowly bought some more land as well. So as we bought more land, we increased our cattle holding.
And you had a day of reckoning during the Black Summer. How close did the fire come?
Well, very, very close. Right up, we have a river that goes along this along just along the front, and we have an avenue of banyan trees, which are huge, great indigenous trees. And if the fire had got to the banyans, it would have come up the driveway and gotten us. And also, we had a lot of what we call oh, what are they called? Well, sort of nature strips where you join the like the river corridor is full of birds. So the idea is to keep the trees going and growing, so that you can so the birds can travel through the trees across the property.
Right.
So, but unfortunately, they became
Corridors,
so they're
yeah.
wildlife corridors. We put them in as wildlife corridors, but the wildlife corridors became the fire corridors. So the fire was gradually coming towards us. I mean, we had been in drought for 3 years, so we didn't have a lot of coverage on the ground, but all of the forests around us were taken. The neighbor up the hill, 300 meters up the hill, was taken. So yeah, it was right there. It was all around us. I was there. I got out that night, but I had sprayed all of the roofs and I'd kept the sprinklers on the garden. So I didn't really feel like the house was going to be taken, but I was sort of wrong to be quite as complacent as that because yeah, the house above me went, and we very nearly did get taken. It was really thanks to my farm manager who did a fire break, who dug a fire break, got the tractor out and dug a fire break that stopped the fire going up the river and then onto the banyan trees.
The documentary gives me the impression that you went into a slump as a consequence of feeling what? Hopeless, disempowered, what can you do?
Yeah, exactly. Disempowered, I think. You know, we had the Morrison government at the time who was walking into Parliament with pieces of coal saying, this is, you know, don't be afraid. And, you know, nothing was moving really on the climate front. And it was that, and it was having a grandchild that year. And, you know, the paradox of being so in love with your grandchild and also so scared for him to think about, you know, climate change and how that was going to change his world and going forward, and his sort of his innocence to what was ahead, really, yeah, I kind of got under my skin, and experiencing that fire, experiencing nature at its most raging was really quite a wake up call. And you couldn't sort of in the end, I mean, it's very easy to blame governments, to blame corporations, to blame our world, but very rarely do we look at ourselves necessarily as part of that problem. And it was really only when I learned that farming was a huge part of the problem that made me go, yes, I've got agency. I can do something with a farm that is bigger than my recycling, or trying to avoid plastic, or things that seemed so small and irrelevant. I actually had a much bigger agency in turning climate around. I mean, even though I knew my little farm wasn't going to make any difference, I felt like I had more action. And that was the difference. That's got me out of my funk of just feeling this sort of existential dread. And just to have not only as a farmer, but as a consumer and a filmmaker, I was actually able to have much more agency. As a consumer, I could choose, because I began to understand that farmers are not going to change until the retailers change, and the retailers aren't going to change until the consumer starts to demanding, you know, produce from best practice farms.
To
So it was
begin
a
with,
change.
yeah, but to begin with,
Yeah, it's a change.
you wanted to
Yeah,
get rid of
sorry.
the cattle. To begin with, you wanted to get rid of the cattle entirely. But then you
Yes,
came
because that.
upon Alan Savory's theories. I've spoken to Alan Savory.
Lucky you, have you?
His theory about
How wonderful.
moving herds of beasts.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, his theory is that he began to understand as he, in his very long career as a conservationist and as a farmer himself, that it was extraordinary the way these great vast pastures in Africa weren't destroyed by the herds. He felt it was the elephants and these great vast herds of buffalo that was destroying the country. And he then realized, after making a terrible, fateful decision to cull many, many elephants, that the problem didn't go away. In fact, it got worse. And he realized that it was actually the farmers who were just keeping cattle in one prescribed area instead of working them naturally as they work, because they can't eat the food in which they dung. So that's why wild herds keep moving. And so they take one nip of the grass before they move on, and they don't come back to that piece of grass till a year later. So it's had all the time in the world to regrow. And that's what keeps it from not being overgrazed, and it keeps the carbon being pulled into the land, and it helps, and the trampling of the animals helps keep cover on the soil. And he went, that's the way. We have to mimic nature. We have to move our cattle around so that they're not nipping and overgrazing. So we had to, in our farm, I mean, he sort of inspired us to, you know, he basically recognized it was farm management, not the animals, that were destroying the land. And so he devised this way, holistic farming, where you basically farm with nature. You understand how nature farms and how nature keeps it all in balance, and that we've come along and destabilized and debalanced that natural way of animals being on land. So, you know, the first thing we did was try to fight, you know, is to join this way of moving your herd around the landscape.
Does it reduce the productivity?
No, absolutely not. It, in a way, it can increase the productivity. The expense at the beginning, so setting it up, is really the restructuring your farm is really where the first initial finance goes. You know, you do have to have a bit of money to do that, but not a lot. It's basically, well, it depends on the size of your farm. It's basically, we broke our farm down from 30 paddocks to 90 paddocks. And we, of course, had to have water points that fed all of those paddocks. So that is that's the initial restructuring that you do, so that you can, we move our cattle around almost daily. Very simple. That's almost all we have to do. I mean, occasionally we repair our electric fences. But essentially, that's what you do from then on, is you move your cattle on, keep them moving so they can't overgraze. So they poo on, they fertilize, they eat in a very intensified mob. So they trample the grass, they poo all over it, and they take a couple of nips, and the next day they're moved on. So you never get that terrible thing where they just keep eating in the same spot, and you get bare soil.
Have you changed the sort of grasses that you're growing for them?
No, not so much at the moment. In order to make the carbon from the atmosphere, in order to build your carbon bank, it does help to have a lot of like clovers. Gotten the name of them, legumes. You need a lot of legumes. So we have put in many more legumes. But no, we've still got the same grasses. We're hoping that more grasses, more indigenous grasses will come up. But actually, we were a forested area. We weren't pasture land to start with. We weren't like it is in the great, you know, over the Great Dividing Range, which is just massive pasture land. So, in fact, if we left our land, we wouldn't have so much natural grasses. We would have reforestation.
In time, and I don't know how long it took, you noticed an improvement in your soil. Now, a skeptic might say, what made your farm, and specifically your soil, so much better was that it started to rain. As you said, you had a drought for 3 years. Then you got some rain. Lo and behold,
of course,
your fertility, of course, the soil. So that was part of it, right? How much was due to the actual farming practice that you employed?
look, you know, for me, the verdict is still out. It does not take 2 years to turn your soil around. What we did see was increasing dung beetles, and that was because we'd stopped using insecticides and worming. And I think that had an effect on the dung beetles. You know, but again, this year, they weren't that many, but you can't be an island, you know, until the whole area changes. I don't really see us being able to really change, you know, the critters that come in to our land. I mean, we've got 340 hectares. I farm with my neighbour so that we can move our cattle around a bigger area. So, of course, having the rain made a huge difference, and I'm not going to Pollyanna it. But, you know, and we won't really see, I don't think we'll really see what we've done with the land until we go back into drought. And then we start to see the fact that our grasses are so much that the, when you allow your grass to grow and when you don't, when you don't overgraze it, the roots work in a corresponding method. So our roots now are so long because our grass is so long, because we're not nipping off our grasses. Our roots are really robust, and they go down and they're able to find the water and find all the nutrients that they wouldn't have been able to do before. Also, because we keep growing, we are banking carbon. We are pulling carbon. We're banking carbon. And carbon is like a water sponge. It holds the water in the soil. Also, what we're doing is we're making swales, and we're using a particular kind of hoe that makes that helps to hold the water, because we're very hilly where we are. So the water just races down, races into the streams, and races out to sea. So we're doing everything we can to try and hold water on the landscape. So more hydrology, really, really looking at the water and anything we can do to hold water. And the fact that we've now got so much compost we don't slash anymore. So all of our grasses have composted up, and our grasses are very thick. I can't see the soil anymore where we are. So that holds water as well. It just slows it all down. And obviously, the more water you can hold, the better for your soil. That's the small bit that we're really seeing the benefit on.
You were very influenced by Charles Massey when you wrote The Call of the Reed Warbler. What's he saying, in essence?
Look, The Call of the Reed Warbler is like the Regen Bible, because what he does is he takes examples of farmers who in Australia who've been doing this for 30, 40 years. And so you can really see, you know, and he describes over the fence. He describes what these farmers' land is like compared to the farmers over the fence. And he talks about the kind of mindset of farmers too, and how rarely the farmer over the fence comes to the one who's doing the regenerative farming and says, "Hey, what are you doing? How come you've got so much grass and mine has gone?" So it's very hard for people. They almost have to have a brain-cracking moment like I had with the fires, or like serious drought, for them to go, "This is not working." And, you know, to Mick Green, my manager's credit, he came to me even, you know, before the fires really, and said, you know, "This is not working either financially or ecologically." Financially, because the price of inputs is just going up and up and up. And on a farm our size, we can't balance that anymore with the amount of cattle we have. So we were just having to spend too much on inputs, too much chemical fertilizer, too much insecticide, too much herbicide. And so we just cut all of that. So although we're not necessarily making more on our cattle, we're saving with our inputs. So we're actually able to balance the books that way. And they've done a lot of accounting in this way, sort of ecological accounting. And the farmers that do the regenerative farming, and the graph, it's much more even. So we don't make the highs, but we don't go to the lows either. So we're not one of those ones who are putting our hand out in disaster, because we are much more we've managed to find a balance there so that we don't make massive profit in the good time with basically overstocking, but we don't lose in the terrible drought time because we're able to hold more cattle. That's the idea. And that's what Charles Massey's book showed.
Yeah.
So it showed, after you read the book, you couldn't not see the evidence of how much not only was the ecology of the land improved, but mental health of farmers was improved as well, because they just weren't on that seesaw of boom and bust.
Mick Green, your neighbour, whom you began this with, his father, the documentary tells us, was disapproving. Was he ever won over? Because, you know, there are a lot of sceptics out there and old school farmers.
No, he hasn't been won over, and he won't be won over. And, you know, the way he's farmed for many years works for him. He has grown up in a time, you know, he's farmed in a time where ecological threats were not part of the thinking. And, you know, he grew up with the Borgland Green Revolution and all of that. So where the saviour for farming was chemical, and he saw the immediate impact of chemical. And there is no question that if you throw urea all over your land, you will get this green, this burst of green. But, you know, it's also very watery, and the trouble is it then very little of it goes into the soil. It rushes off. It goes into the streams. You get this big algae blooms, and that's where you get those big dead zones in the ocean. And that's where all of those urea and chemical fertilizer is just pouring out into the ocean and down the streams and into the ocean. One of the reasons Mick Jr. changed, and Normie, who's in the film at the beginning, they've lived there their whole lives, and they've seen what's happened to the rivers. They've seen the algae come, and they've seen the river go, you know, deplete. They've seen the fish gone, you know, they've seen it, the ecological decline in their lifetimes. And that is chemical fertilizer. That was brought in the 60s and the 70s, and that's the impact of it. Yes, maybe the produce is greater, but the price is there. And the price is obviously what we're paying now for, you know, degradation of our rivers, our soils, our ecological life.
But unless those, unless those externals, external costs are priced into the product,
exactly,
your kind of farming is always going to be for the better off, right?
No, absolutely not. I mean, yes, the people new to it, yes, because they're able to take the risk. But it has now, you know, it's 30, 40 years old. There's a lot of evidence out there. And once you do have to have that initial funding. You know, the thing that cost us was putting in a big header tank and troughs. And electrical fencing costs nothing. But so it was the troughs and the plumbing for our water points that were a bit of a cost. And yes, the first 3 years, well, nature starts to where you balance, you do. We did have a bad first winter where we hadn't quite got where the grass hadn't got hold. You know, you definitely have to have a buffer there. But once that is in place, you are not having to spend on the externals. You're not spending on all those inputs that farmers have to bring in to make their land function. You've got nature on side. Nature's doing it for you. You know, as I said, there is ways which you can increase your abundance, and that's through the animals on your soil and this wonderful way of moving them and not overgrazing. So it really does come down to farm management in order to keep lands healthy for the future. I mean, for the immediacy, yes, throw on the urea and you will get a season of great grass and big, healthy cattle. But that can't last, you know, and we have to start thinking of the changes ahead and putting the brakes on in the way that we are destroying so much of our ecology. So, you know, there is a bit of pain at the beginning, But there's going to be a hell of a lot of pain at the end if we don't do that pain at the beginning. And also, funny enough, it doesn't take, you know, some people can go on doing it in a fairly destructive way, because it actually doesn't take that many of us to convert, to pull enough carbon in to build our carbon bank up and to take carbon out of the atmosphere. You know, if 30% of us did this, we would decrease 30% of the carbon in the atmosphere. I mean, there's all sorts of figures that have been done on this that I can bore you with, but I won't.
I'm sure, but you wouldn't.
I will just say that the gross enteric methane, which is what the cattle burp out, accounts for only, what is it? Only 17, hang on a second, accounts for only, no, that's wrong. Oh, only, no, wait a minute, only accounts for 17% of the entire greenhouse emissions in the US. So it's a tiny percentage of what is being, as what's being, you know, you would think the cattle were entirely responsible for all these emissions, these methane emissions. But they're responsible for a very small amount of the methane emissions. So mainly it comes from leaking gas pipes.
Farmers are very defensive in New Zealand. And New Zealand practice, to be fair, is a little different from Australian practice. And a lot of them claim that they already have rotation grazing, so they have nothing to learn. I suspect you might say that there's more involved.
No, I think if they have rotation grazing, it's you know, they would be able to see. I mean, I have my land tested. I have a land to market. I have an EVO, which is my environmental outcomes verification system. So I get it measured every year so I can see. I get an ecological measurement. So I can see if I'm increasing water retention. I can see if I'm increasing biodiversity. I can see if I'm increasing my microbes in my soil. And I have carbon testing as well. So I'm doing those ecological testing. I don't know if they are, but certainly if they're rotational grazing and they're not in, and they're not overgrazing, and their soil is covered.
There may be chemicals involved. There may be chemicals involved. In fact, you're not entirely chemical free. You couldn't fly.
I'm not entirely chemical.
You could not fight the buffalo fly problem with natural solutions.
And with regen farming, there is a part of it is not prescriptive. It is not like organic. You do not have to be absolutely chemical free. And that's because there are certain things, you know, it's basically about looking at your land, listening to your land, doing those studies and seeing if your land is moving forward ecologically, you are not doing any harm. So that's fine. I don't think anybody in the regen movement is saying that, you know, there's all incremental bits you can do, but it is looking at taking the long view, and it is basically doing the measurements that are not destroying land, waterways, our ecology. And that's very easy to test those things. So if your soil is not moving forward, you're not doing you're not doing regenerative farming. But if it is and you're rotating, you very likely are. You know, you may not be doing the measurements, but you very likely are doing the right thing. I do the measurements because I want to know. I'm in a semi-tropical area, so I'm using, I have to use, my cattle are driven to distraction with something called buffalo fly. And it becomes an animal welfare thing. If I don't spray my cattle, I've stopped using the ear tags, which go internally. And I think that's what's really affecting the dung beetles. So we do a spray twice a year on the cattle externally. And that keeps the dung beetles away from them, not that long. But what we are doing is we're genetically changing now. So we've got this crazy thing is all over Australia, we have Angus cattle because the retailers like the predictability of the cuts and the taste of the Angus cattle. So Angus get a premium at the moment. And it's ridiculous because they're English cattle, they're not suited to our country. We're much more suited to South African cattle. And they make much better use of the grasses, and they're able to deal with our climate. So we're changing from Angus to Mashonas and to Senepals, which are South Africans. And we will take a cut because the market favors the Angus. So until the market starts to favor those that are ecologically helping the landscape, we will be at a disadvantage. But so again, that comes back to the consumer insisting that, you know, getting very savvy about labeling and insisting that their meat, their produce comes from sustainable farms.
You are so involved in this, aren't you? Did you ever think you would be so involved in farming?
No, and I'm so glad I am. I didn't know what a wonderful world it was. I, you know, was so close to it for so long, but I just was not touching it because it seemed like a very male domain to me. You know, the men were always on the tractors. That seemed to me like the women were all doing the drudgery. They were, you know, they were doing the bottle feeding, or they were doing the books, or they were doing, you know, looking after children in the kitchen. Men were having all the fun. And I mean, not fun dealing with all those chemicals, that's for sure. And obviously, you know, when you've got huge weather that men are out in, that's not fun. But I'm a physical person. I want to be out there. I want to be in nature. I want to be with those cattle. Yes, I want to be able to drive the tractors when I have to. I want to be able to be a useful part of it all. And not that, God, doing the books is the most useful part of all. But I think with regenerative farming, it's a much gentler way of farming as well. It's much less dependent on brute strength. And there's much less heavy machinery, big machinery involved. Even people who are doing cropping are using animals in winter to fertilize the ground and to, you know, they do, I'm not in cropping, so I'm not that over it. But they have cover crops in the cropping so that they, while they're growing the tall crops, they've also got a bed of the clovers and the legumes going underneath. And then the animals, they harvest, and then the animals go in to, you know, eat the legumes, to trample and to fertilize. So there's very natural, you know, yes, it doesn't work in that really dynamic, brutal way of, you know, robust growth. But, you know, we really have to stop thinking about farming with all these chemicals.
We could also think about stopping farming animals entirely.
Well, that's not going to happen because we're humans and people, and we like to eat meat. And meat is part of our diet. And I'm no dietitian, but I was a vegetarian for a long time. And I'm now not, because I very much believe that animals are supposed to be on the land. They're part of our landscape. They're part of nature. And they add to it. If you do it right, they add to it. I'm
Excellent.
Very much convinced of cattle and sheep. You know, it's about overdoing it. You don't overgraze. You don't overstock. You can't get greedy. You can't, you know, you have to work with the parameters of nature and what our landscape allows for.
It's very good to talk to you. And thank you for giving us so much time, afflicted as you are with the cold.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. And I don't want to suggest that the documentary is just a manual, a farming manual. It's actually a very personal journey with, particularly with me and my farm manager. And we battle to find a middle ground with the two of us. And obviously very difficult to have for him to have both his boss and his farmhand in one. So that was a tricky dynamic, which the documentary sort of charts, and my sort of floundering movements to become a farmer, to be beholden.
It's very interesting documentary. Thank you so much for your time, Rachel Ward, whose documentary is called Rachel's Farm, and it screens in cinemas and online in the Dock Age Festival next month.